This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Between virtual classes, a little bit of in-person learning, and a whole lot of anxiety, kids did not exactly get a full school year in 2020. And there's a lot of uncertainty for this year, too.
Hi, my name is Michael. I'm a nurse in Pasco County. My son's attending a non-mandatory mask school. What my biggest complaint going into this school year is the planning that's been associated with it. There is no video classes online. There is no plan for quarantine. There is no masked versus unmasked plan for quarantine or anything of this sort. We had a whole year of pandemic and a whole summer to prepare for this, and no one has any answers for me. How can we do better for our children?
Michael, thanks for that message. Today, we're focusing on academics. One study from NWEA, that's a nonprofit organization that provides academic assessments, found that students are behind where they would be in a normal year, sometimes by as much as 17 percentage points. That's especially true for reading and math. For this installment of our Back to School series, we're focusing on elementary through high school. How should we be thinking about where our students are academically and where they should be as we head into this school year? Joining us from Providence, Rhode Island is Prudence Carter. She's a professor of sociology at Brown University and president-elect of the American Sociological Association. She's also co-editor of the book, Closing the Opportunity Gap, What America Must Do to Give Every Child an Even Chance. Professor Carter, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us from Detroit, Michigan is Dara Hill. She's an associate professor of education at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. Professor Hill, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me.
So we mentioned those statistics at the top from NWEA that found all students were behind where they were expected to be. Professor Hill, how do students this year compare to their predecessors?
Students coming into this incoming year are experiencing learning losses that were reported by NWEA. So there's been a precipitous decline in percentile scores from 2019 to 2021, which is certainly a concern moving into this upcoming year.
Professor Carter, we've heard a lot of talk about how much kids learned this year compared to pre-pandemic times. How do you think about what kids did and didn't learn last year?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I think that it's a philosophical question in some ways about how we want to characterize this year, which is a really historic moment for this generation. And for many of us, we haven't had a pandemic of this magnitude in a century. How I characterize it is the degree to which our learners, our students, are diverging from what we expected them to learn from what they actually learned. I don't think that learning loss is the proper descriptive for thinking about children. It starts from a deficit perspective, first of all, and you can't lose what you didn't have already. But we did expect them, because in a typical year, we expect students of different grades to be in a certain place. And it is the case that national studies are showing that in each grade, a significant number of our students are not where we would typically expect them because of the things that have occurred over the course of this pandemic in terms of schooling.
Professor Hill, what about you? How do you think we should be thinking about where we expect kids to be?
I think we really need to focus on where kids are and not where they should be. In order to do that, it's important to focus on mental health. Focus on where students are academically, again, not where they should be. It's really important to put planned curriculum aside, because that really is a source of anxiety for kids whose lives have been disrupted. And it's important to offer intensive tutoring for students. I think these ingredients piece together that really focus on the whole child and focusing on where they are is really critical to reduce learning loss.
Professor Carter, how should we be thinking about using tests as a benchmark?
Well, tests are, in my opinion, are diagnostics. They can actually tell us some things. They can't tell us everything. And so I think teachers can utilize those tests
to ascertain what skills are acquired, have been acquired by students, and what skills have yet to be gained by the students in their classes. To utilize tests as in a high-stakes moment for comparative purposes, for the allocation of resources, or penalizing in punitive ways, I think, are really highly inappropriate for this moment. But certainly, we will need tests to be able to ascertain where students are and where teachers will have to go in terms of their planning and curricula.
Professor Hill, you ran a reading clinic over the summer for younger children. What were your main takeaways from that?
My main takeaways were that we had students who varied in ability ranges from recognition of a few letters and really very early emergent phases of writing to kids who were advanced readers whose families wanted them to have additional enrichment to keep them ahead. So what was interesting was that I really impressed upon my reading specialist candidates to focus on where the students are and inform instruction by the assessment data that they were able to collect and to inform instruction by what's interesting to them. We didn't have any curricular constraints, so the candidates endeavored to bring in culturally relevant reading materials where the students can see representations of themselves in the literature. And this was all done in a virtual platform. Mm-hmm. We didn't have an in-person reading clinic, so.
We'll continue our conversation about the upcoming school year in just a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A. Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
There are arrowheads in the walls.
I'm Ramtin Arablouei.
I'm Rund Abdelfattah, and we're the hosts of Throughline, NPR's history podcast.
And for our special series this month, The Best of Throughline.
You know, if we carry on as we have been, this is what we might wind up with.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
We're discussing how kids fared this past school year and what we can do about the next one. Here's a message we got from Nick.
So as a middle school teacher in Richmond, Virginia, September is going to be the first time I'm back in the classroom since March 2020. We never tried any of the in-person or the hybrid models. I'm anxious about the start, but I'm excited because one big change is that the pandemic allowed our district to become one-to-one with computers. So even if students don't have grates or any broadband at home, this catches us up to a lot of districts and will allow for more creative uses of technology in person. Additionally, I'm going to try and include more social-emotional check-ins and mini lessons as I can weekly, giving more breaks to my sixth graders who, again, haven't been in a classroom since they were at least fourth graders now. And I'm planning a set of outdoor learning lessons for the science standards that I teach, as well as just for mental health and getting out of a crowded school building.
Nick, thanks for sharing that message. Well, like Nick, many schools are planning to reopen in person this fall. Professor Carter, what do you think of Nick's plan for the upcoming school year?
I was just beaming, actually, because it's the teachers from whom we need to listen. They are, in fact, teachers are my heroes, and they are the ones who know best because they have the firsthand glance. In fact, they're the first contact with the students. Nick's plan sounds wonderful to me. And I note that he also focuses on the social and emotional learning of his students. In fact, this has been a traumatizing year for so many learners across the country. Many have lost family members. Many have had COVID to reach inside of their own bedrooms and homes. And so it's really important. And as a result of the isolation, so many of them have not been able to socialize with their peers. There's been quite a bit of isolation. So focusing in on those kinds of skills and thinking about compassion and empathy and sharing and being with others again, and being able to articulate how you feel, those are really important skills that many of our children will need to have cultivated more too.
Professor Hill, what about you? Nick mentioned using technology more creatively, including more social emotional check-ins, building in time outside to teach the science standards. What did you hear?
Oh, definitely. And just as Dr. Carter mentioned, the social emotional check-ins are absolutely critical. Middle schoolers are creatures of schedules, and creates a great deal of anxiety when those schedules are disrupted and they don't have socialization with each other in person. The thought of being in virtual school for a whole entire year is really troubling. But when you think about ways that teachers can be more innovative and incorporate more hybrid platforms to be more tech savvy for themselves and for their students, it's really very important. Having the outdoor space is very calming and very necessary. So it was refreshing to hear his endeavor of prioritizing the mental health of his students. Something else to point out too is that we hear about learning loss and this narrative that's based on racialized assumptions and standardized test scores. There's also a counter narrative at play here. It's important for teachers to really inform instruction by the fact that children have learned about loss and grief. They've learned about racism and family traditions at home. There's a need to focus on teaching informed by learning found during this pandemic and rebuilding our education systems from that learning. So this wasn't a complete and total loss. Students learned in other ways, and teachers must absolutely capitalize on that in their practice.
Well, this is an email we got from Mike who says, I've been describing our kids last year and a half as highly educational, except, of course, for the planned curriculum. Is there any way to measure the resiliency, grit, and flexibility gains that have no doubt resulted from such a volatile time? Every generation seems to have survived a challenge that later gives them an edge. Is this the one for our kids? Your thoughts, Professor Carter?
I actually think that's an excellent question, because these are the kind of more intangible, harder to measure, but certainly time will tell in terms of the creativity, the innovation, the productivity of this generation, the kinds of things they think about, how they contribute to the society. So these are kind of some of the long-term things, but I certainly think that we have a generation of young people who have been exposed to some of the hardest social and emotional and health circumstances than any generation for a long time. I mean, we could even say as far back as a century. And so this will the proof will be in what we see them do as they age.
Professor Carter, how did the pandemic affect the so-called opportunity or achievement gap? And I would assume that you don't like that term gap, because it does come from a deficit. But what are your thoughts?
Well, the opportunity context, the resource context of children matters immensely. I mean, I speak in ecological terms in the sense that we have to think about what resources that are surrounded children, how are they shrouded. And it is real that those students who have less access to various forms of resources, like families like my own that can afford to have tutorials or tutors. I mean, when we first started the pandemic, there was all of this controversy about these pods, pandemic pods that were sponsored by more affluent families. They were hiring teachers,
hiring tutors. So, and then there were students who were going to more affluent schools that actually were more likely to meet in person as opposed to being virtual, and they had the resources for testing. It is real that there is a socioeconomic impact, and this pandemic has compounded the disparities by race and class and ethnicity. That being said, while affluence and socioeconomic privilege can be protective factors, there is variation, a great deal of variation. And I want to acknowledge those parents who are professionals who are also trying to hold full-time jobs like myself, and trying, if they're children, I have a 7-year-old son, who were at home and trying to co-teach while holding full-time 9-to-5, 9-to-6, 9-to-7 jobs. And so there are many of us who are also frustrated by the fact that our children had a lot of work that we couldn't necessarily help them with if we were trying to be in a meeting. So we're seeing, it is the case that the data show that we're seeing that those students from more affluent schools particularly are closer to where we expect. There is still some, they're still not quite where they would be typically than those who come from less privileged backgrounds, who have a lot of opportunity gaps, as we say, in their lives. And then finally, with the digital learning, the digital learning also requires some facility with computers, with broadband, with how to set it up. I can't tell you how many times my computer crashed or I had to figure out something for my son. And so if that kind of human capital and knowledge was not present in the household, I can assume that that also would have been something that would have exacerbated some of the socioeconomic disparities that we see.
We're discussing ideas for helping kids succeed this school year. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
This message comes from Capital One. With the Capital One Venture Card, you earn unlimited double miles on every purchase every day. And you can use those miles toward travel expenses like flights, hotels, rental cars, and more. Just book and pay for your travel using your Venture Card and redeem your miles toward the cost. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Credit approval required. Capital One Bank, USANA. Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult.
We're talking about the upcoming school year. Let's jump back into that conversation. And when COVID hit and schools shut down, virtual learning meant you needed a solid computer and stable internet. That's something a lot of lower income students didn't have access to right away. San Francisco set up learning hubs for lower income students who might not have the necessary resources at home. Joining us now is Maria Sue, the Executive Director of the San Francisco Department of Children, Youth, and Their Families. Maria, welcome to 1A.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So what exactly did these learning hubs look like, and what was it like for the students day to day?
Well, first of all, in San Francisco, when we decided to shut down the city in response to the pandemic, number one, it was really, really hard to make that decision, but we knew we needed to make that decision for the protection and safety for our residents. But in part of making that decision, we knew that people needed to come in and work, particularly our frontline workers and hospital workers and essential service providers. And so the Mayor London Breed, asked our department to stand up in-person care to support these frontline workers. And that was the start of the city moving into this process of opening up in-person care for children during the pandemic. So we started this back in March, and we were able during that time to provide services to well over 300 children of frontline and essential workers. We then became emboldened to then continue, and we opened up summer programs for children because we recognize the importance of having care for children, and then most importantly, providing children with that social interaction. When we realized that our public school system was not able to open for in-person learning and that they were going to go into full remote learning during the fall, That was when we really kicked into gear, the Learning Hub model.
And how have you been able to measure how well these hubs serve these kids?
Well, once again, what we recognized was that our marginalized children would not have access to the stable Wi-Fi that you mentioned earlier. But more importantly, they wouldn't have access to a caring adult, an adult at home, who would be able to help them to stay focused on their classwork or to even figure out how to submit homework, because all the homework was done online. So what we created was these neighborhood-based facilities that essentially opened from 8:30 to 5:30 every single day, where children were able to come, work with a youth development professional, log into their academic program, and you know, receive the three meals a day that they needed. So with all of that, what we found at the end of the school year was that our children continued to thrive. Our children did not suffer as greatly the traumatic shutdown and the social isolation that children who did not participate in a hub. And then more importantly, the children that were in the hub continued to submit homework on time, were able to log in and participate in school for at least 90% of the time and maintain their grade.
And how did you go about identifying kids and connecting them to this service?
So we worked, I'm a city department, so we worked very quickly with other city departments to provide the resources and the human capital to connect to families. Number one, we worked very closely with our Rec and Parks, Recreation and Parks Department to stand up and essentially take over their facilities to operate these hubs. We also opened hubs in our public libraries. We also worked with the church community and opened hubs in our churches and in the private sector, in private sector facilities. We worked very closely with public housing, with our foster care department, with our juvenile justice department, as well as our health department, to identify children who really needed the service. And these are primarily children who were homeless, who were underhoused or in the foster care system, severely low income, did not have stable Wi-Fi, such as children who are living in public housing. And then we also worked with our school district to identify children who were English language learners, as well as children who had some disabilities that would be supported at the hub sites.
Professor Carter, we saw different innovations in teaching and learning because of the pandemic and distance learning. What are some of your favorite learning innovations you've seen over the past year?
Well, the only ones I've seen are the ones I'm most familiar with through my own child. And I want to first say, I give a shout out to the teachers who are heroes of this as much as doctors and nurses are. The important thing, and I want to pick up a point that was said, is to make sure our children were thriving, to minimize the extent of disengagement. And so to have teachers who were really actively working to engage online. My child was in online virtual for most of the year, and then he went back to the classroom in April. That was really important. Thinking about where the children are, I am impressed by some of the digital and technological curricula that were assigned and used as asynchronous learning. And it was developmentally appropriate, it was fun, it was engaging, and the teaching teams in my child's school were very thoughtful about what could engage and grab their attention. So for me, the most important thing during this pandemic was trying to get to cultivate reading and learning. He started the pandemic in kindergarten, hadn't learned to read or barely had learned to read, and by the end of it, he was reading. But the tools that were used, in addition to a teacher who was actively engaging, smaller groups, mind you, so the small groups matter. And then there were breaking the kids down into even smaller groups to work with each other. So peer teaching, peer-to-peer teaching was also helpful. And there was differentiated abilities in those groups. So those who were doing better could help move along and actually influence those who were who needed a little bit more advancement.
Professor Hill, what about for you? Any learning innovations that you saw emerge over the past year that really stand out?
Oh, definitely. The use of Google Slides and Teachers Pay Teachers that have numerous reading foundational skills, you know, phonics skills, learning phonics categories, letter recognition, and even assessment tools that may not look so attractive in a virtual platform. So there's so many ways that teachers make the learning tools look attractive in a virtual platform. Padlet is a way for students to share their tasks in a shared space. Get Epic is a series of ebooks across a variety of genres, which is so useful, particularly for students who don't have access to a lot of literature at home. So for many families, having access to Get Epic and Storyline is just really profound in terms of giving kids access to the world of print. And then sharing interactive videos where students could interact to acquire reading foundational skills was really phenomenal to see. And also teachers sharing screens with students so that they could contribute on their end and not just be a passive receptor of knowledge. And then we think about kids who need to learn how to write and hold a writing tool appropriately, and having kids, you know, put your screen down so that I can, or put your camera down so I can see how you're holding your how you're holding your writing tool, because, you know, it's so hard to model writing virtually. And so, I think too, having a parent in close proximity to acquire these innovations to help their kids at home.
Maria, how crucial were the hubs you opened in San Francisco to mitigating that social and emotional toll the pandemic has taken on kids?
Absolutely crucial. If you talk to parents, and we did a pre and post survey, and we also did an evaluation of our hubs, hands down, parents said that without the hubs, they wouldn't know what to do. We started seeing children regressing when the shutdown happened. So a lot of children who were reading on grade level, doing math at grade level, able to really regulate themselves when they were, you know, suffering a trauma, they started to regress. And once again, this is why the hubs were so important. I really do believe that the social emotional development of children was key what was suffering the most during this pandemic. And so that was what the hubs was intended to support. Of course, we think the world of our teachers, and teachers were amazing and they did their best. But the actual in-person connection was what was missing. And that's why the hubs were so important.
Professor Hill, very briefly from you, things you think we should be thinking about as we move forward and how we educate our kids?
We should definitely prioritize hiring tutors to support teachers and to support one-on-one learning or small groups of students so that they're receiving personalized instruction. And I think that the social and emotional well-being component is absolutely critical. And then for families to connect with nonprofit agencies, and for schools to make those recommendations too, that there's supplemental support provided that is free of charge. And they do support academic proficiency and development. It's so critical.
That was Professor Dara Hill. She's an associate professor of education at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. Also with us today, Prudence Carter. She's a professor of sociology at Brown University and president-elect of the American Sociological Association. She's also co-editor of the book, Closing the Opportunity Gap, What America Must Do to Give Every Child an Even Chance. And Maria Sue, the executive director of the San Francisco Department of Children, Youth, and Their Families. Thanks to you all. Today's producer was Amanda Williams. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.